transition team, and with President Donald Trump still seeking to overturn his election defeat. From some agencies, our team received exemplary cooperation, Biden said in Wilmington, Delaware, after a briefing by his foreign policy advisors. From others, most notably the Department of Defense, we encountered obstruction from the political leadership of that department. Both the Defense Department and Office of Management and Budget, OMB, erected roadblocks, he added. Right now, we just aren't getting all of the information that we need from the outgoing administration in key national security areas. It's nothing short, in my view, of irresponsibility. The president-elect, who takes office on 20th of January, warned that his team needs full visibility into the budget process at the Pentagon in order to avoid any window of confusion or catch-up that our adversaries may try to exploit. The remarks were the latest sign of Joe Biden's increased willingness to take off the gloves in condemning Donald Trump's reluctance to take part in a swift and orderly transition. The current president has still not invited his successor to the White House or confirmed his attendance at the inauguration, as is traditional. Donald Trump fired his Defense Secretary Mark Esper after the 3rd of November election, replacing him with Christopher Miller in an acting capacity. Earlier this month, Biden's team complained about an abrupt halt in cooperation from the Pentagon. The Defense Department claimed that meetings had been postponed until January because of a mutually agreed-upon pause. But Joe Biden's transition team insisted that there is no such agreement. The team also said they had met resistance to requests for information from some Pentagon officials. But a senior defense official told the Reuters news agency that the Pentagon had conducted 163 interviews and 181 requests for information, and that it would continue to provide information and meetings. Donald Trump has refused to acknowledge Joe Biden's victory, claiming widespread voter fraud, for which there is no evidence, and suffering dozens of court defeats. His administration only authorized cooperation with Biden on 23rd of November. Trump has vowed to make a last stand on 6th of January when Congress convenes to certify the Electoral College results. Jenna Ellis, a member of Donald Trump's legal team, tweeted on Monday, "President Trump should never concede the election." Joe Biden was briefed on Monday by his nominees for Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense and Homeland Security, as well as his incoming National Security Advisor. He said his team found that agencies critical to our security have incurred enormous damage during Donald Trump's tenure. Many of them have been hollowed out in personnel, capacity, and in morale. There's policy processes that have atrophied or have been sidelined to the disrepair of our alliances. It makes it harder for our government to protect the American people. Joe Biden's foreign policy team has been described as a return to experience, expertise, and the Barack Obama era, with Tony Blinken nominated for Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan for National Security Advisor, and John Kerry in a new role as Special Presidential Envoy for Climate. Lloyd Austin is facing a confirmation battle as defense secretary because he's a retired general, potentially undermining the principle of civilian control of the military. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is pushing back in a statement. Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller said the Pentagon had conducted 164 interviews with over 400 officials and provided more than 5,000 pages of documents. Our Department of Defense political and career officials have been working with the utmost professionalism to support transition activities in a compressed time schedule, and they will continue to do so in a transparent and collegial manner that upholds the finest traditions of the department, Miller said. But Joe Biden reiterated his team's concerns on Monday. When he takes office, he will inherit a wide range of foreign policy and national security challenges, as well as the coronavirus pandemic raging across the globe. One of Joe Biden's toughest tasks will be rebuilding U.S. alliances that have frayed under 4 years of Trump's so-called America First agenda. My team needs a clear picture of our force posture around the world and our operations to deter our enemies, Biden said. We need full visibility to the budget planning underway at the Defense Department and other agencies in order to avoid any window of confusion or catch-up that our adversaries may try to exploit.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program Ulama Speech. In today's program, we will listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
خبیث تو شبکه‌های ماهواره‌ای یا شبکه‌ها و تبلیغاتشون مرجعیت شیعه رو
The evil Wahhabis via their satellite channels or in their propaganda they say that marja'iyyah of Shia is the marja'iyyah of the Safavid era. The Safavids created the marja'iyyah. The Safavids created these things. It is a complete lie. This network of wakala representatives, which was created from the time of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam and the a'imma, the imams, strengthened this network of wakala, meaning the students of the imams alayhi salam, who were faqihs or jurisprudents and mujtahids, those who have done ijtihad, then continued through the time of ghaiba, a quotation by the name of marja'iyyah. The marja'iyyah is the continuation of that network of representatives that the imams, alayhim as-salam, themselves created. the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam themselves created. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
In the limelight.
U.S. authorities said the 63-year-old suspect in the bombing that rocked Nashville, Tennessee, on Christmas morning has been killed in the blast that destroyed his motorhome and damaged more than 40 businesses. FBI forensic experts matched DNA samples recovered from the scene to that of Anthony Q. Warner, whose home in nearby Antioch was searched on Saturday, December 26, by federal agents. Donald Cochran, U.S. Attorney for Middle District of Tennessee, told a news conference, "We've come to the conclusion that an individual named Anthony Warner is the bomber, and he was present when the bomb went off, and that he perished in the bombing." Officials said it was too early in the investigation to discuss the suspect's motives. Warner's motorhome, parked on a downtown street of Tennessee's largest city, exploded at dawn on Friday moments after police responding to reports of gunfire noticed it and heard music and an automated message emanating from the vehicle warning of a bomb. The explosion in the heart of America's country music capital injured three people and damaged businesses, including an AT&T switching center, disrupting mobile internet and TV services across central Tennessee and parts of four other states. As investigators followed up on hundreds of tips from members of the public, they searched Warner's home and visited a Nashville real estate agency where he had worked on computers. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article authored by Stephen Lendman, Chicago-based author, research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization and host of the Progressive Radio News Hour, entitled Nashville Explosion, Lone Bomber or False Flag. Please stay with us to hear more about the issue. On Christmas Day, a recreational vehicle exploded in downtown Nashville, Tennessee, outside an AT&T transmission building, one block from the company's office building. What happened knocked out communications and 911 emergency call centers over a wide area, including parts of neighboring Kentucky and Alabama. Was the motive behind what happened what official reports claimed, or was something else responsible for the blast? Was it a false flag? It's unclear at this time. What is known is that numerous U.S. false flag attacks occurred before, notably since at least the mid-19th century. They are a U.S. tradition at strategically timed moments. Before the blast, The Tennessean reported that Nashville residents in the affected area were warned before the incident occurred, saying a recorded warning inside the vehicle said, "Evacuate now. There is a bomb. A bomb is in this RV and will explode." An area resident says whoever did it gave fair warning 15 minutes before the blast. Fox News Nashville TV reported that city police got people to safety before downtown explosion. The following day, FBI agents raided the home of a person of interest, following more than 500 leads. That many in hours after what happened is highly suspicious. How is it possible to identify a possible suspect hours after the incident, including before an investigation began? Nashville police called the incident an intentional act, a likely suicide bombing. No mass casualties occurred, just 3 injuries reported and the remains of an individual identified as Anthony Quinn Warner. Was he responsible for the incident or a convenient patsy to blame for what he had nothing to do with? Before ID from DNA, his residence was searched by federal agents in a Nashville suburb, as explained above, a disturbing red flag. Why his home alone and no others? Why before an investigation began? No motive pointing to him is known. Did what happened follow pre-planning to name him for the incident before occurring? As the saying goes, dead men tell no tales, so he is unable to defend himself. Reportedly, police and FBI agents aren't looking for other suspects, another disturbing red flag. Who is Anthony Quinn Warner? Local media called him a loner, an unmarried man with no children. According to the Tennessean, acquaintances described him as a self-employed computer guru and a homebody who tended to his pets and kept to himself. A next-door neighbor called him a little odd but friendly, adding if he had any political beliefs, that was something he kept to himself. Another neighbor called him a recluse. Local authorities claim that the RV, or one similar to the detonated vehicle, was seen outside his residence for years. Nothing known about Warner explained above suggests the motive for what happened, one more red flag. What happened in Nashville is reminiscent of 2 earlier incidents. In April 1995, a truck bombing killed 168 people and caused extensive damage in Oklahoma City. Within 90 minutes of the incident, Timothy McVeigh was arrested on a firearms charge, spent 2 days in jail, then was charged with the bombing. On May 10th, Terry Nicholas was named his alleged accomplice and arrested. Experts, including professional demolition contractors, concluded that only high-grade military explosives, detonators, and proper multiple internal placements could have caused such extensive destruction. Allen Air Force Base Armament Wright Laboratory studied the incident. It concluded that no single truck bomb was involved. Brigadier General Benton K. Patton, an explosives and ordnance expert, said a truck bomb couldn't cause the steel-reinforced concrete columns to collapse, adding, "The total incompatibility with a single truck bomb lies in the fact that either some of the columns collapsed that should not have collapsed, or some of them are still standing that should have collapsed and did not. This is a classic cover-up of immense proportions." Patton said to cause the damage pattern that occurred to the Mora building, there would have to have been demolition charges at several supporting columns bases at locations not accessible from the street to supplement the truck bomb damage, adding, "A careful examination of photographs showing the collapsed column bases reveal a failure mode produced by demolition charges and not by blast from the truck bomb. More forensic evidence showed other devices were involved, what major media suppressed. Yet, McVeigh was executed for the incident, Nicholas sentenced to life imprisonment. General Patton and others believe they were framed, used as convenient patsies. So were falsely charged Tsarnaev and his brother Tamerlane for what's known as the April 2013 Boston Marathon bombing. Local police lethally shot Tamerlane near Watertown, Massachusetts. Tsarnaev was arrested, falsely charged, convicted, and sentenced to death, later reversed to multiple life sentences. Neither brother was involved with the incident. A state-sponsored false flag. Like many times before in the U.S., innocent patsies were wrongfully punished. Innocence wasn't enough to save them. Was the Christmas Day Nashville incident the latest example of wrongfully charging a convenient patsy despite no motive or evidence of involvement in what happened? Perhaps what's unknown at this time will be revealed later without public attention to set the record straight if the incident was other than what's reported.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On the news line.
The United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places, like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years. But the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks working in the mines, in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do, but they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced. It must be enforced by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with the massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. president said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. It's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money and it'll be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we got to also remember that the Democrats are now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkili said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressor's bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in the war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is a last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadlines set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
In the limelight.
While the U.S. president golfed, Americans suffered. People are losing their extended unemployment benefits, said the senator from Vermont. They're going to be evicted from their apartments because the eviction moratorium is ending. Although U.S. Congress has recently approved a compromise relief bill that would have temporarily averted catastrophic expiration of critical unemployment and other benefits, including an extension of the federal eviction moratorium during the deadliest period of the pandemic, Trump declined to sign the measure into law, blasting its $600 direct payments to Americans as a disgrace and calling for $2,000 stimulus checks instead. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, the writer. This article is published under the heading, Unbelievably Cruel. Sanders slams Trump's intransigence as millions lose unemployment lifeline. Stay tuned for the details of this article. Senator Bernie Sanders on Sunday, December 27th, led progressive lawmakers in condemning President Donald Trump's refusal to approve a $900 billion COVID-19 relief and a spending bill as unemployment coverage expired for millions of Americans on Saturday night, December 26th, as a result of his intransigence. What the president is doing right now is unbelievably cruel, Sanders said during an appearance on ABC's This Week, Sunday morning. Many millions of people are losing their extended unemployment benefits. They're going to be evicted from their apartments because the eviction moratorium is ending. Although U.S. Congress has recently approved a compromise relief bill that would have temporarily averted catastrophic expiration of critical unemployment and other benefits, including an extension of the federal eviction moratorium, during the deadliest period of the pandemic, Trump declined to sign the measure into law, blasting its $600 direct payments to Americans as a disgrace and calling for $2,000 stimulus checks instead. Representative Rashida Tlaib, one of only two House Democrats to vote against the bill, also called its $600 payment woefully inadequate. I have watched as many of my colleagues rush to provide billions to corporations and wealthy individuals while admonishing the needs of the majority of families, Tlaib explained recently. Republicans continue to do all they can to poison our society further with corporate greed, while abandoning the very people they are supposed to be working for. This is evident by the inclusion of the three lunch tax giveaway, she added, referring to a tax deduction for business meals included in the bill. However, Sanders has argued that the terrible economic crisis facing the U.S. makes action imperative. We're looking at a way to get the vaccine distributed to tens of millions of people, Sanders said, referring to the massive nationwide effort to distribute COVID-19 vaccines. There is money in that bill. Progressive lawmakers from across the U.S. joined Sanders in urging the relief bill's passage. Here we are with people living on the edge as a result of this pandemic, and Trump is playing with their lives and their livelihoods, said Representative Barbara Lee during a Saturday interview on MSNBC. People can't afford to live life on the edge. 8 million more people have fallen below the poverty line. Joe Biden also joined the chorus of bipartisan voices calling on Trump to sign the bill. It is the day after Christmas, and millions of families don't know if they will be able to make ends meet because of President Donald Trump's refusal to sign an economic relief bill approved by Congress with an overwhelming and bipartisan majority, Biden said in a statement on Saturday, December 26. Trump remained defiant following the expiration of jobless benefits. I simply want to get our great people $2,000 rather than the measly $600 that is now in the bill, he tweeted. Also, stop the billions of dollars in pork. While the president golfed, Americans suffered. Lantris Haynes, a self-employed single mother of three in South Bend, Indiana, braced for the loss of her $129 weekly lifeline. It's a chess game and we are all pawns, Haynes told the Associated Press.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
The Israeli regime has been intensifying its moves in the region as media revelations suggest it is intending to build a military base on the Yemeni island of Socotra. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has condemned these suspicious moves, promising Israel a decisive response in case it commits any stupidity against the Yemenis.
The Israeli move is not new, as it is running the region through some puppet regimes. The Yemeni position is clear as it was 6 years ago. We are in the midst of a war launched by Saudi Arabia with the tacit backing of American and Zionist regimes.
The Israeli media have boasted the arrival of the submarine to the Bab al-Mandab Strait after crossing the Suez Canal. An Israeli military spokesman also confirmed the move, claiming the step was taken to counter smart drones Iran could potentially launch from Yemen or Iraq.
The presence of Israeli entities in the Yemeni territorial waters dates back to the beginning of the Saudi-led aggression. It was just a year ago. There were plenty of statements by some Arab rulers pledging to stop what they claimed the Iranian expansion in the region. However, the same rulers are silent on the Israeli agenda. They have not only normalized their ties with the regime, but allow its submarines pass through the Red Sea.
It seems that the Yemeni army's possession of missile systems capable of reaching as far as Eilat has become a nightmare for Israel and its cronies. Tel Aviv knows that it will not be immune to the Yemeni retaliation. However, sending one of its submarines is yet another provocative move by Israel to set the region on fire.
Israel is still using Iran as a pretext for its interventions in the region that, despite the exposure of its agenda, especially in Yemen, which is suffering from a war led by Saudi Arabia, but was actually jointly hatched by some Arab regimes and their backers in Washington and Tel Aviv. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani 1 year after his assassination by U.S. forces in the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani played a major role in strengthening Palestinian resistance movements against the Israeli regime.
We commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of the great commander Haj Qasem Soleimani, who died for the sake of Jerusalem al-Quds. This anniversary comes amid great pressures on the resistance in the region. On this occasion, we vow to follow in the footsteps of the commander to liberate Palestine.
Following the assassination of General Soleimani, Palestinians held several events to pay tribute to the late Iranian commander. They considered him as a hero for Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds.
On the anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we express our great gratitude for sacrifices he made for the sake of oppressed Palestinians.
The assassination of General Soleimani on Donald Trump's orders has sent shockwaves across the West Asia. Soleimani's memory continues to live in the hearts and minds of Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip.
Palestinians will continue to remain steadfast and condemn the treason by some Arab countries that have normalized ties with the Zionist regime. On this occasion, Palestinians also vow to fight the occupation until regaining their freedom.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike on January 3rd.
Palestinians say Martyr Qasem Soleimani has sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds and has always supported Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of the former commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, General Qasem Soleimani, people are now holding commemoration ceremonies to pay respect to this late Iranian icon. We went to the city of Qom, where a movement called Resistance Youth Front is formed to support the cause of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who defeated the ominous phenomenon of Daesh. Scholars, youth, activists, and resistance movement supporters from countries like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India attended the ceremony to tell the world that General Soleimani's cause will not be forgotten.
It's a great pleasure for all of us, for all the people of the world who are free, who just think freely, okay? So such kind of attribution actually led us to not only memorize or recall their memory, actually also to follow their path. That is the path of humanity. That is the real war on terror, war against terror.
Shahid Qasim Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, they fight for saving the life of all mankind, of all Muslim and non-Muslim.
General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated by a U.S. strike on January 3rd last year when he was on an official visit to the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Heading his convoy, the assault also led to the death of many others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, or Hashd al-Shaabi. Apart from the ceremony held here, within the coming days, a number of other events will be held across Iran under health protocols to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani. Human Abedi, Qom.
Afghans are a nation with a long history of resistance against various enemies. Since 19th century, Afghanistan has been invaded by different armies. The Colonial Army of Britain, the Red Army of the Soviet Union, and the Black Army of Terrorism, along with its international backers. They all tried to break the will of Afghans. As experts say, the existence of a resistance spirit among Afghans has helped them to make contacts with other resistance figures beyond the Afghan borders. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was one such figure who was interested in having ties with anti-terrorism and anti-hegemony resistance movements, mainly across the Middle East and some other Asian countries, including Afghanistan.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was popular in many societies like Afghanistan. He was a charismatic leader who fought terrorism and helped many oppressed nations to strongly stand against terrorism.
Many others also believe that the charismatic personality of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani revives for Afghans the memory of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. It becomes more interesting when you understand that both Soleimani and Massoud had friendly ties before Massoud's assassination, only 2 days ahead of the 9/11 attacks.
Lieutenant General Soleimani had a transnational personality. He had close ties and cooperation with our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud and Professor Rabbani, who were leading anti-terrorism resistance in northern Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that many here in Afghanistan believe the slaying of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was leading regional resistance against terrorists, is not an endpoint in the fight against terror. Rather, his assassination has made the resistance front all the more determined in its campaign against terrorists. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first 5 volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included 3 elderly patients with underlying health conditions and 2 healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the 2 doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against the pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in 3 phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers, And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its third hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a third corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear